On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse Q&A, we talk with licensed professional counselor Tali Kadosh about attachment styles, trauma bonding, love, and abuse. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse Q&A. With me today, I have Tali Kadosh. How are you?
Great. I'm good. How are you?
I am good. And today we will be discussing attachment styles, trauma bonding, and narcissistic abuse. For everyone listening, Tali is a licensed mental health professional counselor specializing in addiction, depression, anxiety, and narcissistic abuse. She is formerly an expert witness for domestic violence survivors and has been in practice for 11 years. You have trained with Dr. Eric Gentry, who wrote the book Forward Facing Trauma. Your email is Kadosh, K-A-D-O-C-H-T-A-L-Y. @gmail.com. And thank you for being on the show with us today. And for those of you that want to be a guest on our Survivor Story episodes, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. At the top of the page, press the guest form button. You'll read all the instructions and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form, press the submit button. And today, myself and Tali Kadosh. Oh, I forgot to even say that I am Brandon Chadwick. I completely forgot to do that for the people that have never heard this before. I am Brandon Chadwick. I am the host of Narcissist Apocalypse. And today we're going to talk about attachment styles. And we're going to talk about four attachment styles. So, Tali, can you please enlighten everyone about attachment styles?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So the four attachment styles are secure, avoidant, anxious, and disorganized. So secure attachment would be a little bit more autonomous. Avoidant would be dismissing, not really able to tolerate emotions, pushing back. Anxious is a preoccupied attachment, and disorganized is unresolved. So what does all that mean? Adults with these attachment styles differ in a number of significant ways, such as how they perceive and deal with closeness and emotional intimacy, their ability to communicate their emotions and needs and listen to and understand the emotions and needs of their partner, the modes of responding to conflict, or their expectations about their partner and the relationship, which is what we call the internal working models.
So I guess there are the three of these, I guess, are primary underlying dimensions that characterize attachment styles and patterns. Can you discuss what these dimensions are?
Yeah, the first dimension is closeness, meaning the extent to which people feel comfortable being emotionally close and intimate with others. The second dimension is dependence or avoidance, which is really referring to the extent to which people feel comfortable depending on others and having partners depending on them. The third is anxiety, or the extent to which people worry their partners will abandon and reject them.
I guess all of these dimensions lead into your attachment style that I guess is regards avoidance, closeness, and anxiety. So can you give us a more of a thorough definition of all of these styles?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about a secure attachment, we are talking about an individual who has low avoidance, low anxiety. This individual would be comfortable with intimacy, not necessarily worried about rejection or abandonment. They're not preoccupied with the relationship. It's relatively easy for that individual to get close with others. They are comfortable on depending on them and having others depend on them. These individuals have formed a really good bond with their primary caregiver, which is how attachment styles develop. So the way that they are attached from infancy really is how these attachment styles develop. The avoidant is more someone that you would think of as high in avoidance, low in anxiety. They are uncomfortable with closeness, and they primarily value their independence and their freedom. They're not necessarily worried about their partner's availability. They are relatively uncomfortable being close to others and find it difficult to trust and depend on others. They kind of prefer that no one really depend on them either, so you'll see that these individuals push intimacy away. They really want to feel independent and self-sufficient, and they are not comfortable being intimate. The anxious attachment style is low in avoidance. They're pretty highly anxious. They sort of crave that closeness and intimacy. They're very insecure about the relationship. They want to really merge with others and be emotionally close. They often worry that their partner might leave them or abandon them, or that their partner won't need them. And a lot of times this need for closeness really scares other people away. And then you have the anxious and avoidant, which is an individual that you could think of as being very high in avoidance, high in anxiety. This person would also be uncomfortable with intimacy and worry about their partner's commitment and love. They are, again, uncomfortable getting close to others and find it difficult to trust or depend on others because they are concerned that they are going to get hurt by a partner. So more of a combination, but they do tend to be highly anxious.
So I myself at one time was an anxious attachment. I probably still have anxious because I think everyone tries to want to move towards a secure attachment. And I think maybe I have an anxious, possibly avoid a combination of the anxious avoidant. What would be yours?
You know, I myself also think I relatively have an anxious attachment style. And it is something that over time has come to my attention, and I am as well working towards a more secure attachment style.
Yeah, 'cause for me, when I discovered attachment styles was when I saw my first therapist, and it was one of the first things we established was, I guess for her purposes, when we were doing work, was to figure out my attachment styles so we could kind of break down my relationships and how to help me work out of codependency to have more loving and real love type of relationships. So the first thing we tried to do was break down what attachment style I was using and then go from there. That's why I think this is a really important episode, because a lot of people don't know or haven't had awareness of what their attachment style is. And I think, when you're aware of that, it's easier to work towards healthier relationships. once you know these little things about yourself. And, you know, with these attachment styles, you know, there's behavioral, cognitive, and social aspects of each style. And the way in which they differ regarding closeness, dependency, avoidance, and anxiety, there's a combination of stuff going on. So is it it's common for adults to have a combination of traits rather than fit one style? So can you kind of break down, you know, these further as far as all of these types of traits?
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct. This is a relatively unconscious process that sort of starts in infancy, really, and many people go years without necessarily having insight as to what their particular attachment styles can be. It is common for adults to have a combination of traits rather than really fit into just one style. I think that most individuals will find that they are leaning more to one style or another, but absolutely depending on external circumstances or even the partner that they are with, those traits can shift and feel like a different attachment style. So the autonomous individual who, as we said earlier, is relatively secure and comfortable in a warm, loving, and emotionally close relationship. They're able to depend on a partner, allow a partner to depend on them. They are available for a partner. This person also accepts a partner's need for their own space or separateness, and they don't feel rejected or threatened by that. They can also be independent at the same time, so they are not needing that closeness all the time. They're trusting, a little bit more empathic and tolerant of differences, and forgiving. The way that they communicate emotions, needs, is pretty honestly and openly. They tend to be attuned to their partner's needs and respond appropriately. They don't necessarily avoid that conflict. These are individuals who manage their emotions well. They're not overly upset about relationship issues. Insight, resolution, and forgiveness about their past relationships is pretty high. And, you know, they're sensitive and warm and caring. And you'll see this in the parenting style. They are pretty attuned to their child's needs and needs. And so these are the children that you would consider securely attached. And again, that attachment later translates into the adult relationship. Whereas the dismissive or avoidant individual is emotionally distant and rejecting in intimate relationships. They keep partners sort of at arm's length. They're always kind of holding off a little bit, even when their partner wants more closeness. They detach from their needs, the partner's needs or feelings and behaviors. If this equates sort of an intimacy that with loss of independence, they prefer autonomy altogetherness. So they are really, you know, independent individuals and actually prefer to be that way. They are not able to depend on their partner or allow their partner to lean on them because their independence is such a priority. The communication can be rather intellectual as opposed to talking about emotions. The avoidants tend to avoid conflict, but later on what you'll see is that they can become very explosive They appear externally to be very cool and controlled, sometimes even stoic. They are compulsively self-sufficient and have a very narrow emotional range. And again, they really prefer to be alone. These individuals tend to be pretty good in a crisis because they take charge. They are not as emotional. But they can be thought of as an unavailable parent, one who might be disengaged and detached. And the children are also likely to have avoidant attachment. Anxious, attachment styles are very preoccupied, as we kind of mentioned earlier. They are relatively insecure in their intimate relationships. They're constantly worrying about rejection or abandonment. They tend to be really preoccupied with whatever relationship they're in. There's sort of a hyperactivity that their attachment causes, and their behavior is reflective of that. They're often thought of as needy or requiring ongoing reassurance. They want to merge with their partner, and often that scares the partner away. Some other things that you would see in an anxious person would be that they ruminate a lot about unresolved past issues, whether that's from family of origin or relationships. Their family of origin actually tends to really intrude into their present perceptions and their present relationships. So they're often afraid or hurt or angry and are sort of consumed by this rejection. They're very overly sensitive to their partner's actions and moods in a disproportional manner. And their partner usually takes their behavior too personally. Highly emotional. They're also very argumentative or combative, angry. They can be thought of as controlling because their boundaries are so poor. And their communication is not really collaborative. And they're unaware of their own responsibility in the relationship or in the relationship issues. So you'll see that they often blame others. And they're unpredictable or moody, and they sort of stir the pot because the way that they connect to others is through conflict. These parents would be thought of as inconsistently attuned with their children, and therefore the children are likely to be anxiously attached. And we have the last one, which would be the unresolved, which can be thought of as disorganized. The unresolved would experience this unresolved mindset, unresolved emotions. They're often frightened by memories of prior traumas, losses from the past, haven't necessarily been resolved. They have a difficult time tolerating emotional closeness in a relationship, and they are as well argumentative. They might rage, or they're really unable to regulate emotions. So they end up with very abusive and dysfunctional relationships and recreate sort of the past pattern. They also can be thought of as having intrusive and traumatic memories and triggers. And they do dissociate at times to avoid the pain. They experience severe depression, and PTSD, which PTSD is really just a stress response. They can be antisocial and lack empathy or remorse. Sometimes they can be aggressive or punitive, a little bit narcissistic in the sense that they don't really have regard for rules. You'll see a lot of substance abuse and criminality in individuals. And again, these parents are likely to maltreat their own children. The script sort of in the children comes up with the past unresolved attachments, and they're triggered into anger and fear by the parents, and the child interaction often develops disorganized and disruptive. Children learn how to connect from parents and caregivers, and what happens is that, you know, as an infant, your primary caregiver might be mom, who's very detached, and you might develop an insecure attachment there. And maybe later on or towards your formative years, you have a pretty strong connection with dad, who is more a secure attachment style. So this history sort of plays a crucial role in determining how you end up relating an adult relationships. So it definitely, you can see some overlap or some confusion. With narcissists, that what you would see with narcissists is in the grandiose narcissist, they tend to align with the avoidant attachment style of relating, in which the person really learned to rely on themselves and adapted to feel as if they really don't need anything from others. And, you know, they develop this sort of tendency to detach or disregard and not care about other needs. Most of the people who are really affected by a narcissist are more the anxious attachment style. Those who they have this anxiety response to the narcissist devaluing and discarding, they're likely to experience that trigger of their attachment anxieties. And when those anxieties are triggered, it can take a really long time for them to calm down. And again, that's sort of the post-traumatic stress response in those who were abandoned or rejected, and those wounds are being triggered again. The anxious responses to having close relationships abruptly, it's not really taken lightly. These are infants who experience a disconnect with a primary caregiver, like we discussed, and that disconnection really can be thought of as a threat to their life. It's very serious to them. As infants, they depend entirely upon that parental figure for their survival. And the infants and the young children whose needs were not met on a consistent basis will either end up avoidant or anxious, depending on their primary caregiver and their response. And those attachment styles, again, are transferred to adult relationships.
So can you discuss how the trauma bond fills the void of a certain type of attachment style?
So let's talk about what trauma bonding is. Trauma bonding is, it's a loyalty to a person who is rather destructive. The idea of bonding, I think, generally brings up a connotation of something good and beneficial, But trauma bonds are unhealthy. If you ever have a chance to look at Patrick Carnes in his book Betrayal Bonds, there are a number of signs that a person is involved in an unhealthy bond with a partner. And some things to consider in determining whether or not you're in a trauma bond with someone is things like there's a constant pattern of non-performance, and yet you continue to believe promises to the contrary. Others might seem disturbed by something that has happened to you or was said to you, and you're not. So everybody's had that friend who kind of expresses concern, and you're like, you don't feel that. You feel stuck a lot of times because the other person does continue doing these destructive things, but there's this belief that there's nothing that you can do about it, and again, maybe that you believe in those promises. Oftentimes, you try to change a person into becoming less destructive by trying to get them to stop either an addiction or abuse. There's repetitive, damaging fights with this person where nobody wins. You're sort of unable to detach from someone, even though you can't trust them. And a lot of times, you might not even really like them. When you do try to leave this person, you find yourself missing them to the point of longing. That's really pretty awful. And you have this belief that it's going to destroy you. Trauma bonds, again, they usually occur in relationships involving the inconsistent reinforcement, such as those with addicts and alcoholics or domestic violence situations. Dysfunctional marriages can also cause trauma bonds because there's always a time when things seem to be normal, and other types of relationships involving the trauma bond are not consistent, end up as not normal. So there's that confusion. Other types of trauma bonding that we know of include the cult-like religious organizations, kidnapping, and hostage situations. And if you remember, Stockholm, Sweden was, where the term Stockholm Syndrome came from, because the hostages were really bonded to the people that took them hostage because they were so grateful that they didn't hurt them or kill them. And in the end, you'll see that those same hostages almost forgot that they were hostages and will often protect their kidnappers. The environment necessary to create a trauma bond usually involves intensity, complexity, inconsistency, and again, that promise. Victims stay because they're holding on to that elusive promise or that hope that something will change. There's always manipulation involved. Victims are prey to the manipulation because they are willing to tolerate anything for the payoff, and that's that elusive promise and ever-present hope for fulfillment of some deeply personal need within the victim. So often, those in traumatic relationships are they're looking right at it, but can't necessarily see it. Usually after time away from the unhealthy attachment, a person can begin to see the destruction it caused. And so in essence, these people really need to detox from trauma bonds by breaking them and staying away from the relationships. Avoidants they're not all narcissists. We can't contribute all avoidant traits of a narcissist. But they do have the ability to detach emotionally from the relationship, which triggers the anxious person's attachment anxiety. Avoidants are not comfortable with too much closeness, so their relational dynamic is to push their significant other away to create a safe emotional distance. However, these anxious partners who desire a lot of closeness with their partner experience being pushed away as rejection and abandonment, which triggers that deep-rooted anxiety. Avoidants also tend to find fault with their partner and blame them for any issues in the relationship. And the funny thing is that anxious styles tend to find fault with themselves and blame themselves. So in essence, all fingers are pointing towards the anxious person because they're both pointing at the same thing, which explains why the anxious person feels responsible when the avoidant detaches from the relationship. When a relationship between an avoidant and anxious ends, the avoidant can rather easily detach from the relationship and move on, where maybe the anxious person is really plagued by a strong need to reconnect with that person. And this, it's the strong need to reconnect. It's often not logical. It's a deeply entrenched emotional pattern. The avoidance behavior can be abusive and unacceptable, but it doesn't really change the anxious person's strong pull to reconnect because, again, there's something deeply ingrained in that anxious person that feels that their very survival depends on the connection with that person. And, you know, the irony in understanding these styles is that if an anxious style hooks up with a secure style, these anxieties can be calmed oftentimes through the consistent feedback. And the anxious person becoming much more secure in the relationship. Even when the relationship ends, the anxious person is not as triggered in the way that they would be with an avoidant partner. And that's because there is open or honest communication and feedback where the secure person shares in the responsibility for the relationship issues. The problem with mate selection is that avoidance represents the largest share of available single people on the dating scene because avoidance tend to be commitment phobic and can so easily sever their bonds when there's conflict in a relationship. They avoid conflict, and all relationships have conflict, so there's little resolution, and issues are swept on the rug, and relationships break up sooner rather than later. Whereas if you have an anxious type, the good news is that you can have a healthy, successful relationship. You just need to know where to look. Secure types don't usually present as the charming or highly charismatic, mysterious individuals that might be the most seductive. The anxious types may find themselves a little bored without the drama created with an avoidance, but trading in the drama and intensity for security, for the stability in a relationship, will actually give the anxious type the foundation to develop trust in their partner's ability to be there for them on a consistent basis. So in other words, it can really assist the anxious type to thrive in the light of that security.
So a big problem people have is leaving their abuser because the toxic trauma bond is so difficult. But also, once they do leave, a big problem is recovery because that trauma bond is so strong. So can you give us a handful of ways that people can help recover from a toxic trauma bond?
Sure. So just to kind of recap, trauma bonds tend to occur in these toxic relationships, but they're strengthened by inconsistent positive reinforcement or at least the hope of something better to come. And they tend to occur in extreme situations such as abusive relationships or hostile situation, sometimes incestuous relationships, but also in an ongoing attached relationship in where there is a great deal of pain interspersed with times of calm. That's kind of the key there. And I liken it to a heroin addiction. The relationship promises, these feelings of utopia and then sucks away at your soul. And so the good news to all of this is that there is hope on how to break free from this type of stronghold. And things to combat a trauma bond would be make a commitment to live in reality. So if you find yourself wanting to fantasize about what could be or what you hope will be, reminding yourself that you have made a commitment to live in what's actually true. Even though you don't choose to leave the relationship immediately, in the meantime, you can at least remind yourself that you will stop fantasizing about what's not happening. Another sort of tip would be living in real time, which basically means to stop holding on to what could or will happen tomorrow, and start being mindful, noticing what's happening in the moment. Notice how trapped that you feel or how unloved you feel and how you've even compromised your values, your self-respect, and self-worth for this relationship. It really requires paying attention to your emotions and stop the hoping and waiting so that you can start noticing in real time what is actually happening and what's affecting you. And another coping skill is to live one decision at a time and one day at a time, which is a huge thing in the addiction world and the recovery world. One day at a time, because sometimes people scare themselves with all or nothing thinking. So it's best not to get into extremes, such like, I'll never talk to this person again. This is like kind of trying to lose weight by telling yourself that you can never eat chocolate cake again. So while it's true that the relationship is unhealthy, you don't need to make every encounter a do-or-die situation, because that just often sort of scares people. Making decisions that only support your self-care is another way to overcome this, and that is working on not making decisions that hurt you. And this goes for emotional relapses as well. If you find yourself feeling weak, try not to berate yourself, but rather talk to yourself in compassionate, understanding, or reflective ways. Remind yourself that you are a work in progress, and life is a journey, and things, you know, it's progress, not perfection. Don't make the uncaring decision to mentally beat yourself up. In every encounter you have the object of your obsession, stop and think about each choice you make. Make choices that are in your best interest. And this is a general good rule in the recovering world. If you really find yourself kind of berating yourself, that's a good indication to talk to yourself in that compassionate, understanding way, so that you are able to remember that it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. It's important to start feeling your emotions. Whenever you're away from the toxic person in your life and feel tempted to reach out to them for reassurance, that's a signal that you should stop. And the alternative is, you know, consider writing your feelings down instead. Write whatever comes to you. For example, I feel this way, and I miss so-and-so. I wish I could be with this person right now, but I'm not going to sit and write my feelings, but I am going to sit and write my feelings down instead. I am going to teach myself how to feel my way through the obsession rather than turning to it. And this helps to build your inner strength and learn to be with your emotions. And again, these are all things that are very good coping skills in any kind of addiction, because addiction sort of involves that aspect of not wanting to deal with your emotions. So it's learning that you don't need to run from them or hide from them, avoid them or make them go away. You can fully feel them and validate them. And that in turn will allow them to begin to subside. Sort of the only way out is through. Learning to grieve is also major in overcoming this. Letting go of a toxic relationship and breaking a traumatic bond may be one of the hardest things that that you ever have to do. You can't do it without honoring the reality that you're losing something that's pretty valuable to you and in some ways might have even served a purpose for you. So understand the quote-unquote hook, which is, you know, identifying exactly what you're losing. Whether it's a fantasy, a dream, an illusion, perhaps your partner has convinced you into believing they were going to fulfill some deep unmet need. And once you can identify what this need is or what this hook is, you can get down to grieving. And grieving just means, in this sense, holding your hands open and letting it go. You say goodbye to the notion that you may, that it might never be met.
When it comes to this one, when we've had someone, an adult children or narcissist specialist on the show, and a question that we once had was for someone who had a narcissistic mother, they'd been no contact forever. But when that mother died, the person was very upset and very distraught, and she was very, very confused. And, you know, the answer for them was you weren't grieving that your mother died. You were grieving that you were never going to get that illusion or dream or fantasy in your head that your mother was going to eventually wake up one day and call you and love you like she never was able capable of. But it was still in them, even though they had gone past it. It was still in there, and that's what they were finally grieving over, because they were never going to get it. And that, I guess, was probably for them the last part of the process, and probably a very difficult process because it was so deep inside them, they couldn't even see it yet.
Yes, absolutely. And that's really the key. That's really it. It's grieving the idea that it will not ever be met or ever be met by this relationship. And sometimes you see people who, you know, the parent may not have actually passed away, but they severed ties, you know, and still grieving that that need is never going to be met or never going to be met by that relationship, which is, you know, it's a very powerful feeling. Some other, you know, some other, there's really a lot of different things, you know, to work on. But I suggest also, you know, writing a list of bottom line behaviors for yourself, because oftentimes these types of addictions really cause you to maybe tread outside your boundaries. You know, some good things to sort of focus on for yourself is, you know, I'm not going to sleep with someone who calls me names, or I want to argue with someone who's been drinking, or I'll take care of my own finances. I won't have a conversation with anyone when I'm feeling desperate or obsessive or defensive. But it's something that you know, each person has to sort of determine what their area of concern is. And then sort of write those bottom line behaviors for yourself. And, you know, I think a huge tip for healing in general is to start building your life. So little by little, you know, starting to dream about your future, or what your future can hold, or, you know, your children, if you have children. In other words, a lot of us kind of walk around, you know, as zombies or hoping that others will fulfill our needs. But when you start to make dreams for yourself, or dreams that do not involve this traumatic partner, is, you know, when you can start to sort of build your own life. So, you know, maybe you want to go to school or start a hobby or join a club. It's, you know, really making life-affirming choices for yourself that take you away from the toxic interactions that have been destroying your peace of mind, and place it in a more hopeful context, and one where you are able to achieve it for yourself. And that goes sort of hand in hand with obviously building healthy connections, and which I think is really the only way to really free yourself from these unhealthy connections, is when you start investing in healthy ones. So I know, like in substance abuse, you know, we say like, you have to change people, places, and things, because if you're surrounding yourself around, you know, toxic people, it's going to be very hard to eliminate those habits. So developing, in this sense, developing other close, connected, and bonded relationships that are not centered on drama or toxicity. You know, making these your to-go people, because it's so difficult to heal without support. So notice the people in your life who have shown you loving concern and care, and, you know, choose to hang around them as often as you can. And many times, you know, people do need to reach out for professional help, to learn how to identify these things and then put them into action and apply them.
So now that we've gone through all of that, we have, and for everyone out there, there's a lot of information. So if you need to listen to this episode more than once, listen to it twice, three times. Tali is giving you a fantastic information on how to improve your life. In our first audience question, we're about to do audience questions, is a great question. And it's something I need to learn and everyone needs to learn, which is, how do you go from avoidant or anxious attachment to having a secure attachment style?
Yeah. So, you know, that's like the $1 million question, right?
Yes.
Like with everything else, acknowledging, you know, just like any other problem, acknowledging the problem is 50% of the solution. So in this case, acknowledging your attachment style and accepting your role in it is going to be, imperative to begin the process of healing. Learning how to self-regulate and heal. Understanding the behaviors that go along with your attachment style so that you can then learn or develop new patterns. Another important piece to this is because this does often stem from past or trauma, learning to think of your story in a different way is essential to really building on your self-concept. Learning to think of others in a different way. You see a lot of people with those core beliefs that others can't be trusted or they're hurtful, and so really learning to think of others in a different context is essential. And, you know, learning to change old behaviors and learn to more secure new behaviors is what's going to ultimately help develop more secure patterns of attachment.
And our last question. What is the difference between trauma bonding and love?
So as we said earlier, trauma bonding does attempt to meet unfulfilled needs such as rejection and betrayal. It's often an attempt to re-empower the individual who has been traumatized, and boundaries are often non-existent or, very limited. So need meeting is very one-sided. And actual love is built on, shared experiences. So acknowledgement of mutual values and respect for individual differences, while couples in love do seek to meet each other's needs, this process is based on healthy boundaries and understanding each other's needs and the realization that meeting personal needs should not be the sole responsibility of one partner. So, love is almost like a negotiation in many ways where, each person or each side has to kind of state their needs and their bottom lines, and then you sort of have to negotiate your must-haves or can't do, and but there's more harmony in that process as opposed to trauma bonding, where it is very one-sided.
Well, Tali Kadosh, I want to thank you for being on our show once again. Just for
Thank
everyone.
You.
You're welcome. And just for everyone out there, we will have Tally's information in the description of the show. She can be reached at kadoshtally@gmail.com. That is kadoshtally@gmail.com. Tally is a fantastic professional, and if you need a professional or are looking for a professional to help you with narcissistic abuse, your attachment styles, Tally is available, and she is a great counselor. So thank you for being a part of our show once again. And is there any last little thing you want everyone to know before we leave?
Just that help is available, and it might sound overwhelming or impossible, but it is definitely doable, and it's a process that many individuals go through and have to work through in their lives, so it is possible, just to let people know.
Well, thank you. And once again, before we leave, if you want to be a guest on our Survivor Story episodes, please do go to NarcissistApocalypse.com. Top of the page, press the guest form button. Fill out our guest form after you read our instructions. Please do read all of our instructions. Or send us an email at NarcissistApocalypse@gmail.com. And for those of you who need support, please do go to NarcissistApocalypse.com and click on our support group button. Inside there, you'll see that we have our very own safe social network. We have episodes that never made it to air. We have episodes that are ad-free. We have Zoom meetings every Wednesday night and Saturday night and every other Thursday afternoon. We also have forum boards for people to chat on there as well. So please do go to our safe social network. Click on the support group button at the top of the page at NarcissistApocalypse.com, and we will see you there. And if you need even more support, please do go to domesticshelters.org. They are friends of ours, and at domesticshelters.org, you can have articles and resources that can help you make sense of what you're experiencing. They can connect you with local resources like shelters as well. They can help you heal and move forward. So please do go to domesticshelters.org. It is a free resource, so access it today. And once again, I want to thank Tally Kadosh for being here with us today. And from Tally and myself, we hope you have a good night.